Now, it's The Six with the Jeff Calkins Show.
Good Lord, Carolee!
Right now, I'm at Gary Parish. Gary Parish of the Gary Parish Show. 46 everything today. Gary is a national college basketball. He's not here, but I'll introduce him anyway. Gary Parish is the national college basketball writer for CBS, CBSSports.com. He is a multiple Emmy-winning television personality and a rising star in the field of meteorology. He joins me now. GP, how are you?
I'm okay. All things considered, I'm okay. My family's healthy. I'm still employed, so like I'm doing better than some.
Okay. So you're on vacation this week. Do you are you home again? every vacation's just like. And what's vacation when you just got kids there? Like, how much of a vacation is that?
Oh, it's no vacation. I mean, I quote unquote vacation means I'm not doing 2 hours of radio every afternoon. That's it. I mean, I've got magazine stuff that needs to be written that I commit to every year and then regret it every July. I wrote a column yesterday for CBS Sports. I'll write another one today. I've got to do a Facebook watch video for CBS Sports. The idea that I'm just like sitting around is not true. My life is not put together in that way. But not having to think about radio all day long is somewhat of a work relief because
right.
I'm not somebody who you know does whatever I want to do till 2 o'clock and then says, "Ooh, I got a radio show in 2 hours. What am I going to do?" Like, I think about it all day. I work on it all day. So not having to even put that in, on a to-do list is beneficial, obviously.
Your column is about what might happen with the college basketball season. I'll get to that and your thoughts on Musa Cisse in a bit. Before I do any of that, just some random questions I was thinking about with respect to you. What mm-hmm. what mask do you prefer?
I own cloth mask, and I know that that's not the same as what the surgeons might wear in your local hospital, but, and I can't stress this enough to the anti-mask crowd, literally every reputable doctor in the world right now is saying that any mask is better than no mask when it comes to decreasing the likelihood that you will spread this virus to other people if you have it. So I have a University of Memphis mask. I have multiple Grizzlies mask. I have multiple New York Mets mask. And I keep them in my glove box. And every
Did you buy them? Did you buy them all? Were they given to you? How do you get all the? And how do you feel about wearing? Like, if someone captures you, Gary, wearing a Memphis mask, you'll be forever seen as a Memphis homer in your Memphis mask.
I stopped caring about that a long time ago. Like, I'm a graduate of the University of Memphis. Like, I don't know why I have to hide that from somebody. You know, I think my track record speaks for itself. You know, when I need to say that the University of Memphis is wrong, or acting and doing things that I don't think are smart, or when I need to say that the University of Memphis should fire its basketball coach, I've done all of those things. And so if Scott Van Pelt can openly be a graduate of Maryland and still host SportsCenter, I don't know why I can't be me, you know, and acknowledge that, yeah, I grew up a Memphis fan. I'm a graduate of the University of Memphis, and I want good things for that university. So that one was given to me. I didn't buy that one. That one was given to me by a friend, but I bought, you know, the Mets mask from MLB.com, and I bought the Grizzlies mask from NBA.com or whatever the website is that leads you to that place.
I actually was looking for a mask the other day, and I didn't have my I wear the Bleed Memphis mask a lot, and I left it. I didn't have it. So I grabbed one of those papery ones. You know, the light.
Sure.
Those are more comfortable, I think. They're easier to breathe through. They're not as heavy. And a doctor told me the other day they're actually better than the cloth ones. So I actually liked that. I don't know. I mean, I've been wearing the Bleed Memphis one. All right. Second question. Were you surprised when Tate Reeves explained why herd immunity is preposterous? How about that?
I thought he got hacked. I thought he must have been hacked. I wanted to send him a direct message and be like, yo, is this you? Like, I appreciate what you're saying, but this can't possibly be you. And that's why I was compelled to retweet it. Like, not that what I say matters on any sort of macro level, but I have been critical of the governor of my home state over and over again in recent months because his approach to this pandemic has been nonsensical BS. I mean, his initial response to this back in March was not to close the beaches and the bars. It was not to tell people to social distance or wear masks. It was to tell folks to pray. Like, we need to pray harder. And I'm not anti-prayer. Like, I understand, you know, the need for that as it relates to some people. So I'm perfectly happy to listen to you if you say, we're going to close our beaches, we're going to close our bars, we're going to please beg people to social distance, and we're going to ask people to wear masks, and we're also going to pray. Like, okay, sure. Like, I'm happy to put prayer on the list. But when the list is one thing, and the one thing is prayer, I can't do anything but roll my eyes at you. There is no way to, it's nonsensical to try to fight a pandemic with prayer without doing the other things. And so I've been real frustrated about his leadership in general, but especially as it relates to this pandemic. And so to see him speak intelligently to the non-believers who live in this state, who live on my street, was appreciated. To dismiss the idea that herd immunity is a solution and to implore people to wear masks is an undeniable step in the right direction. And so I'm sure he and I don't agree on much more outside of that, but I do appreciate him, you know, tweeting what he tweeted yesterday.
It's so rampant now. It's unfortunate. Truly tragic. But just to summarize for people, basically what he says, I'm not a healthcare expert by any means, but I am a math guy and I have thoughts. The experts say we need 70 to 80% of the population to get COVID-19 to achieve herd immunity. Now, mind you, the news that I gave people just before the break was there may not be no such thing with herd immunity in this particular virus because it may come back again and again and again. It may be more like a cold than chicken pox. But anyway, let's just put that aside for a moment. He says, let's assume they're wrong, and we only need 40% infection for herd immunity. In Mississippi, our population is 3 million. We've had 36,680 cases so far. We need 1.2 million infections to achieve hypothetical 40% threshold, which is, again, half of what the experts say is actually needed. Over the last 2 weeks, our hospital system has started to become stressed to the point of pain. We are starting to see early signs and effects of it becoming overwhelmed. We had to suspend elective surgeries again. On our worst day of new cases, we had just over 1,000. It has typically been between 700 to 900 during this most aggressive time. To get to 40%, which is, again, half of what the experts say you need, and again, who knows if this thing exists anyway, we'd need 3,187 new cases every day for a full year from today. You would need to triple their worst day every single day for a year. And so he goes on to say, herd immunity is not anything like a realistic solution in the short or midterm. I wish it was. Unless you're willing to go without hospitals after a car wreck or heart attack, we need a different approach. Right now, masks are the best bet, hell of a lot better than widespread shutdown. Please wear one. That is the governor of Mississippi. Boy, that's something, isn't it?
When the governor of Mississippi is now on board with mask wearing and diffusing the idea of herd immunity, like, who's on your side anymore?
Literally everyone has gone on the other side. You're exactly right. Who is on your side?
Except I got a guy who lives three doors down from me who continues to insist that masks don't help, as if he knows more than, like, the leader of the CDC who was on television yesterday saying that we could stomp this virus out or at least get it under control if we just wore masks. There are two brothers on
my Facebook
page.
For six weeks. Like, that's it. 6 weeks. Just do that.
I got two brothers on my Facebook page right now trying to tell me that masks don't do anything. Now, let me tell you the only two things I remember about these brothers, because I actually grew up with them. They lived literally next door to our school. Their house was next door to our school. They were never at school. We would go out for recess, and we'd see them in their backyard. Like, it's my only memory of them. But these two guys are, like, they now know everything about the pandemic and what fights it and what doesn't, and that masks don't matter. And the idea that those are real people, that's the thing. I can ignore bots on Twitter because I know they're not real people. But when I see real people, like a guy who lives on my street, or these morons who I grew up with insisting that masks don't help, it is absolutely infuriating because they are the reason, they and people like them, that we don't have this virus better under control. They are the reason that my youngest children are probably not going back to school next month. They are the reason, and people like them, that we're not going to have college football in the fall, that we're not going to have college basketball in the fall. And it is absolutely infuriating that in the face of science and actual data, they continue to be just as dumb as you could possibly be when it comes to this specific thing.
You have pretty much made the decision. You believe that your kids are not going back to school?
Yeah. I mean, Aiden will go back to Lausanne as planned because they have really put a lot of thought into how they're going to go about this while acknowledging that it might not work. You know, they said, we're going to try this, but understand, within a 24-hour period, you may be asked to stay home. So be prepared for that. But we're going to give it a try because we.
And what's the ask? What? Give me some of the ideas of what Lausanne is doing. Some of the sense of what Lausanne is doing.
I don't have all the specifics, yeah. So like, please don't hold me accountable for anything I might be slightly incorrect about. But one of the things, my understanding is that on a normal school day, everybody remembers you go to English at 9, and then you're out at 10, and you go to algebra and whatever sophisticated classes they take at Lausanne. I know it's not as simple as I'm making it out, but like whatever, you change classes and you're in a class with different students and you're walking through the halls. They are not going to do that. The idea would be if Monday is Spanish class for you. So you and a bunch of people in your Spanish class will be in Spanish class, you know, pretty much all day, if not the entire day. You're socially distanced in the classroom. That way you're not in the hallways, you're not, you know, changing classes, going into rooms with different people. It makes contact tracing more, it makes it easier to contact trace if you need to do that. And so, you know, I don't have any idea whether this will work, but I know that they've thought it through. I know that, and I know that Aiden will be surrounded by other students whose parents, for the most part, are responsible, sensible humans. I don't say this to be funny, or I'm not sure my little dudes would be surrounded by the same type of children if they went back to their schools. I don't see the same types of plans from their schools, obviously, because they don't have the same type of resources that a private school would have. And so I believe our options are to opt in and opt out by tomorrow, and then we can reevaluate after every 9 weeks. So I think our plan right now is to keep our little guys at home. You know, my wife is a teacher before she was a successful children's store owner, you know, so she's equipped to do this. She doesn't want to do it. I don't want her to have to do it, but she can do it. And so we're going to keep them at home and then look up in 9 weeks and see where we're at, because there's at least a chance it won't go well and everybody will be sent home at some point. And if that's the case, we would have at least started in the right place rather than had to go there abruptly. And then if it does go well, and I'm not ruling that out either, if it does go well, then we can, push them back into the school system 9 weeks later. And, I mean, we're talking about a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, so it's not the biggest deal in the world.
Well, and it does drive home that one of the bits of news today was how that L.A. County, L.A. school system and San Diego school system are having only virtual learning. I mean, it's a tragedy for the development of kids across this country, and certainly there, where there's a lot of kids who do not have a lot of advantages in that area. And what's learning going to be like at home?
I even say, like, my wife's a teacher. She taught in the school system before, decided to open a business. And even then, like, I'd be lying to you if I told you we spent March, April, and May doing actual school. Like, that's not true. We did some, but certainly not enough, not what either of them would have gotten in a normal school, because, I mean, we're like a lot of families. We're just trying to hold it together. You know, there was a column in the New York Times a couple weeks ago by a woman, and she was like, you can either have a job or you can be a parent, but right now you can't be both. And obviously that's a hyperbole to some degree, but the point remains the same. Like, Kelly's still got a store to run. I've still got multiple jobs, and our kids are here basically 24 hours a day. You know, when we need them to be distracted by Disney Plus or an iPad just so we can do what it is we need to do to do our jobs successfully and pay our bills. And And you know, they're getting shortchanged. And I think that's probably true with most families right now. And so none of this is ideal. I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. I never forget that I'm luckier, we're luckier than most, but even us, you know, with all the resources we have, we're not getting through this, you know, smoothly. It's been bumpy, and I imagine it'll continue to be.
Along the way, you just said, this is why we're not going to have football in the fall. It's why we may not have basketball in the fall. You wrote about that in your column, or the fall and in the winter. The basketball may not start on time. Let's just generally, like, what's your outlook generally?
I don't think we'll have sports in the fall at the collegiate level, and it's way up in the air about whether we'll have them at all. You know, that's just the truth. I mean, you can keep listening to people who don't talk to people who actually make these decisions, and they can tell you what they think, but they don't know anything. You know, I'm actually talking to the people who have a role in making these decisions, and nobody is optimistic right now. They were optimistic in March because, like, in March, September seems like a million years away. But, like, now it's not. And we're not better off than we were in March. We're worse. I mean, we're worse off as a country right now than we were 4 months ago. And I know that there is now a real plea with people around this country to take this more seriously, to stop having your stupid pool parties, to put on a mask when you go anywhere. But, you know, I don't know that enough people listen or care or understand or believe. And so, you know, it's one thing to build a pseudo bubble like MLS has done or the NBA has done and try to pull that off. I do think that's possible, but there is no bubble or pseudo bubble when it comes to college athletics. And if we know that student athletes are testing positive on basically every campus in America every week, how does that get any better when we bring another 10,000 students to campus and they're bouncing around from one class to another, from one, you know, restaurant to another, from one apartment to another, and then coming into a locker? It's just not going to work. And so I think at this point, while refusing to speak in absolutes, I don't put it at 0% chance, but I do put it really low that we're going to have sports in the fall. And then the most likely scenario, if we have sports at all, would be conference-only schedules starting sometime after the new year. What that does is it buys you time to maybe get this virus under control as a country. It buys us time to maybe, against most odds, but still maybe have a vaccine that's available. But then conference-only schedules also, you know, the NCAA, like with Major League Baseball, they can implement testing protocols that apply to the Cardinals and the Cubs and the Mariners and the Astros and everybody else. College athletics can't do that. They have no control over, you know, one school as it relates to another. But the Big Ten can do that to Big Ten schools, and the ACC can do that to ACC schools. And so what I've had multiple coaches tell me is that, you know, we're not going to, at the power conference level, test, positive test, quarantine, contact trace, spend all this money and time trying to do this responsibly and then put our team on the court or on the football field with a team from a lesser conference that doesn't have the same type of resources. We don't know the last time the players were tested. We don't know how often they're tested. We don't know who's positive and who isn't. We're just, at that point, all of our testing, you know, is for nothing. But if you just play other people from your league, the Big Ten can put in rules that says Wisconsin and Michigan and everybody else, you have to test this often. You have to test on these days. If you get a positive test, here is what you have to do. That way you can feel somewhat comfortable going onto the field, at least knowing that everybody is being held to the same standard and everybody is being tested just as often. To me, that is the most sensible approach under these circumstances and also the most likely outcome.
So what does that look like for, let's just take the University of Memphis. What might it look like? When might they start playing? Just whatever. Predict wildly now. I'm not holding you to it.
Yeah.
What could it look like for the University of Memphis basketball team?
Well, I mean, you could start in January. You can start in February. You can start in March. I mean, the people who run college basketball are already talking about maybe we should move the season up. Now, I don't think they're going to do that, but the fact that they're saying that out loud – suggest they know they can move things around. And so if you eliminate conference games, and I mean non-conference games, and I should say this, in addition to eliminating the problem of you putting your team on a court with a team from a lesser conference that isn't tested as often, you don't know what they're, you know, when they're tested, how they're tested, it also eliminates bye games becoming money losers. Because what most programs from power conferences, their non-league schedules are comprised of quote-unquote bye games. For people unfamiliar, those are games created when a school pays another school a certain amount of money, let's just call it $100,000. That in some cases that's low, in other cases that's high, but like it's a round number, so let's use that. You pay $100,000 to get somebody to come play you, and that's it. That's the end of the deal. You don't have to go play them somewhere else. And so I just looked at Louisville's schedule last night for the purposes of my column. Louisville last season played 11 non-conference games. 7 of them were bye games. So the majority of their schedule is bye games, and that's not uncommon for power conference school. Now, the purpose of these is you pay, if you're Memphis, Austin Peay, $100,000 to come play you. And then you make that game a part of your season ticket package. And season ticket holders have to pay for that game the same amount of money that they pay for a Cincinnati game or for a Wichita State game or for a Houston game. And so you pay Austin Peay $100,000, and then you sell 13,000 season tickets with that game part of the package. It's an easy way to spend $100,000 to make millions of dollars. And so that's why schools play these games, to build a season ticket package they can sell to create revenue. Well, what if you can't have fans? Well, then you're spending $100,000 to get Austin Peay to come play you, and you're not making any money off of it because you don't have people in FedEx Forum. So this is the other motivation for power conferences. They don't just want to eliminate the idea of playing against teams from lesser conferences that don't have the same testing protocols in play. They don't want to pay $100,000 to a team to come play them when you can't sell tickets to that game. You can't sell, you know, popcorn at that game. You can't sell parking at that game because fans aren't going to be able to come. So you're going to just scrap all of that, I would imagine, and get to conference-only schedule starting sometime in 2021 with the main goal, and really the only goal, in whatever form, of putting a 2021 NCAA tournament on television, because that is the real moneymaker in college basketball. You've got to be able to hold that tournament and put it on TV. And so if you can have it with fans and domes, that's great. But if you can't have it if you can't have it with any fans, you still need to have it if possible. And so it'll be unusual. The selection process will be complicated. But everything right now in this world is unusual and complicated. So you do the best you can. But do I think the University of Memphis is going to be playing Murray State in November or December or whenever that game is scheduled? No, I'll be shocked if that happens.
You're suggesting that they'll be able to get out of those bye games on some basis of a like force majeure clause. They can just tell Murray State or whoever it is, listen, we can't play you, etc., and we're not going to pay you a check. When Memphis is on the other side of it,
right,
in the Purdue football situation, their argument is, listen, you're playing football games. You can play games. You can say you're not playing games you want. You're choosing not to play this game, and so you should still play. So you still owe us. Have the ADs you're talked to all convinced that people can get out of these payments as easily as you suggest?
They are convinced that there's a way out of the games without paying full cost. This is where I point out I'm not a lawyer, and these contracts are different.
They're all different. Each one's different.
Yeah.
Yes.
Each contract is different, and you know, the lawyers will ultimately settle this, but the people I'm talking to are confident that, you know, negotiating a buyout out of these buy games, right, if that's what necessary, is still less expensive and less risky than actually trying to play the games. And so at this point, again, you know, while acknowledging it is middle of July and November is a long way away, at this point, if I were betting, and forget me, when I talk to athletic directors and people who work in conference offices and basketball coaches, if they were betting, almost to a person without exception, nobody really thinks that you're going to see Kentucky play Northern Kentucky in November at Rupp Arena. Like, that is becoming less likely by the day.
All right, two other questions, and I'll let you go. One is, it appears Musa is definitely deciding tomorrow, he says. Most people seem to think Memphis. That's a good thing, right?
Of course. You know, like, I'm always careful when talking about this because, like, there's an LSU fan saying, why do you think it's a good thing if he goes to Memphis?
It's a good thing for Memphis. I meant it's a good thing for Memphis.
Yeah, it's a good thing for Memphis. And, I live in Memphis. I host a radio show in Memphis. It's better for me if Memphis is doing well. I enjoy it more than when Memphis isn't doing well. And so he's a real difference maker. I mean, I don't think it's an overstatement to say he could be the best rim protector / defensive center in college basketball next season. And when you understand that Memphis was awesome defensively last season, like, that gets kind of lost, but they were great on the defensive end of the court. And you add a real rim protector to, you know, the majority of that roster coming back, it suggests that they we can already identify at least one thing they're going to be really good at. And that's, you know, keeping other people from scoring on a per possession basis. So right now you won't see Memphis in anybody's top 25, including mine, but I am planning to update tomorrow after Musa commits somewhere. And if he commits to the University of Memphis, I believe that they will be in my top 25 and one, because, you know, suddenly you've got a roster filled with top 100 players and they're not all freshmen. There's a big difference between freshmen and sophomores in college basketball. And when you add an elite freshman to a roster that's got quality sophomores like DJ Jeffries and Lester Quinones and Damian Baugh and, on down the line, that's a team that's built to be successful.
Okay, and then finally, five things. I asked Jeffrey this yesterday. You get to bring five things that aren't just your average things. Like, you bring razor, toothbrush, clothes, etc. Five things into the bubble. What are you bringing into the bubble?
My computer.
Yeah, I'm giving you a laptop. So and your phone. But if you want to bring an iPad or something, that's extra. Or like an Apple TV, or so, as opposed to the TV that's on the wall at the Disney Resort.
Well, I would definitely. Well, I don't. If I got my laptop, I don't necessarily need an Apple TV. So I'm not going to waste one of my things on that. I'll just watch Apple TV or Netflix, okay, or HBO. I can watch it on my computer. Bring New Amsterdam vodka.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
What flavor? What flavor are you bringing?
Regular 80 proof. Okay. Just 80 proof regular old New Amsterdam.
Yeah, by the way, any snacks you have to bring. That's true. Any food, drink, snacks you have to bring other than just water.
I'm not really a snacker, you know.
Really?
I don't really snack. I don't, listen, I'm not going to lie. Like, if I'm walking by and you've left an Oreo sitting on the table.
If you're bored in the middle of the day, you don't get 3 o'clock, go down and like find something to eat just for fun.
Really, I don't really snack. If I lived by myself, you would find zero cookies, brownies, sweets of any kind in my home at all. You would never find it. It would never be here.
Well, maybe you don't eat anything. You bring your golf clubs. We're allowing golf clubs. You'd bring your golf clubs, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I'd bring my golf clubs.
That's about all you need. New Amsterdam vodka, your laptop, and your golf clubs. That would get you through.
I mean, that's going to get me through today. I don't know. If I can get through today with just that stuff, I don't know why I need much more than that in the bubble. I think that would just about do it. I'd give my other
two
my
to
other
someone else down the hall.
To one of my teammates down the hall who needs more than I need. I'm fairly simple. I don't need much.
Thank you, GP.
Don't miss the Jeff Calkins Show tomorrow at 9 a.m. on 92.9 FM ESPN.